Side 8.
Well, said Ivor as he tightened his embrace, you're caught now, Anne. She made an effort to release herself.
It's not Anne. It's Mary.
Ivor burst into a peal of amused laughter.
So it is, he exclaimed. I seem to be making nothing but floaters this evening. I've already made one with Jenny.
He laughed again, and there was something so jolly about his laughter that Mary could not help laughing too. He did not remove his encircling arm, and somehow it was all so amusing and natural that Mary made no further attempt to escape from it. They walked along by the side of the pool, interlaced. Mary was too short for him to be able, with any comfort, to lay his head on her shoulder. He rubbed his cheek, caressed and caressing, against the thick, sleek mass of her hair. In a little while, he began to sing again. The night trembled amorously to the sound of his voice. When he had finished, he kissed her. Anne or Mary, Mary or Anne, it didn't seem to make much difference which it was. There were differences in detail, of course, but the general effect was the same, and, after all, the general effect was the important thing. Dennis made his way down the hill.
Any damage done? He called out.
Is that you, Dennis? I've hurt my ankle so, and my knee, and my hand. I'm all in pieces.
My poor Anne, he said. But then, he couldn't help adding, it was silly to start running downhill in the dark.
Ass, she retorted in a tone of tearful irritation. Of course it was.
He sat down beside her on the grass and found himself breathing the faint, delicious atmosphere of perfume that she carried always with her.
Light a match, she commanded. I want to look at my wounds.
He felt in his pockets for the matchbox. The light spurted and then grew steady. Magically, a little universe had been created, a world of colours and forms. Anne's face, the shimmering orange of her dress, her white, bare arms, a patch of green turf, and round about a darkness that had become solid and utterly blind. Anne held out her hands. Both were green and earthy with her fall, and the left exhibited two or three red abrasions.
Not so bad, she said.
But Dennis was terribly distressed, and his emotion was intensified when, looking up at her face, he saw that the trace of tears, involuntary tears of pain, lingered on her eyelashes. He pulled out his handkerchief and began to wipe away the dirt from the wounded hand. The match went out. It was not worthwhile to light another. Anne allowed herself to be attended to meekly and gratefully.
Thank you,
she said, when he had finished cleaning and bandaging her hand, and there was something in her tone that made him feel that she had lost her superiority over him, that she was younger than he, had become suddenly almost a child. He felt tremendously large and protective. The feeling was so strong that instinctively he put his arm about her. She drew closer, leaned against him, and so they sat in silence. Then, from below, soft but wonderfully clear through the still darkness, they heard the sound of Ivor singing. He was going on with his half-finished song.
Le lendemain, Félix plus tendre, ne voulant déplaire au berger, fut trop heureuse de lui rendre 30 moutons pour un baiser.
There was a rather prolonged pause. It was as though time were being allowed for the giving and receiving of a few of those 30 kisses. Then the voice sang on.
Le lendemain, Félix, peu sage, aurait donné mouton et chien pour un baiser que le volage à Lisette donnait pour rien.
The last note died away into an uninterrupted silence.
Are you better?
Dennis whispered.
Are you comfortable like this?
She nodded a yes to both questions.
Trente moutons pour un baiser.
The sheep, the woolly mutton, ba, ba, ba.
Or the shepherd?
Yes, decidedly he felt himself to be the shepherd now. He was the master, the protector. A wave of courage swelled through him, warm as wine. He turned his head and began to kiss her face, at first rather randomly, then with more precision, on the mouth. Anne averted her head. He kissed the ear, the smooth nape that this movement presented him.
No, she protested. No, Dennis,
Why not? It spoils our friendship, and that was so jolly.
Bosh, said Dennis.
She tried to explain. Can't you see, she said, it isn't our stunt at all.
It was true.
Somehow she had never thought of Dennis in the light of a man who might make love. She had never so much as conceived the possibilities of an amorous relationship with him. He was so absurdly young, so...
She couldn't find the adjective, but she knew what she meant.
Why isn't it our stunt? Asked Dennis. And by the way, that's a horrible and inappropriate expression.
Because it isn't.
But if I say it is?
It makes no difference. I say it isn't.
I shall make you say it is.
All right, Dennis, but you must do it another time. I must go in and get my ankle into hot water. It's beginning to swell.
Reasons of health could not be gainsaid. Dennis got up reluctantly and helped his companion to her feet. She took a cautious step.
Oh!
She halted and leaned heavily on his arm.
I'll carry you,
Dennis offered. He had never tried to carry a woman, but on the cinema it always looked an easy piece of heroism.
You couldn't, said Anne.
Of course I can. He felt larger and more protective than ever. Put your arms round my neck, he ordered.
She did so, and stooping he picked her up under the knees and lifted her from the ground.
Good heavens, what a weight!
He took 5 staggering steps up the slope, then almost lost his equilibrium and had to deposit his burden suddenly with something of a bump. Anne was shaking with laughter.
I said you couldn't. My poor Dennis.
I can, said Dennis without conviction. I'll try again.
It's perfectly sweet of you to offer, but I'd rather walk, thanks.
She laid her hand on his shoulder and, thus supported, began to limp slowly up the hill.
My poor Dennis, she repeated, and laughed again.
Humiliated, he was silent. It seemed incredible that only 2 minutes ago he should have been holding her in his embrace, kissing her. Incredible! She was helpless then, a child. Now she had regained all her superiority. She was once more the far-off being, desired and unassailable. Why had he been such a fool as to suggest that carrying stunt? He reached the house in a state of the profoundest depression. He helped Anne upstairs, left her in the hands of a maid, and came down again to the drawing room. He was surprised to find them all sitting just where he had left them. He had expected that somehow everything would be quite different. It seemed such a prodigious time since he went away. All silent and all damned, he reflected as he looked at them. Mr. Scogan's pipe still wheezed. That was the only sound. Henry Wimbush was still deep in his account books. He had just made the discovery that Sir Ferdinando was in the habit of eating oysters the whole summer through, regardless of the absence of the justifying. R. Gombauld, in horn-rimmed spectacles, was reading. Jenny was mysteriously scribbling in her red notebook. And, seated in her favourite armchair at the corner of the hearth, Priscilla was looking through a pile of drawings. One by one she held them out at arm's length, and throwing back her mountainous orange head, looked long and attentively through half-closed eyelids. She wore a pale sea-green dress. On the slope of her mauve-powdered décolletage, diamonds twinkled. An immensely long cigarette holder projected at an angle from her face. Diamonds were embedded in her high-piled coiffure. They glittered every time she moved. It was a batch of Ivor's drawings, sketches of spirit life, made in the course of tranced tours through the other world. On the back of each sheet, descriptive titles were written: Portrait of an Angel, 15th March 20, Astral Beings at Play, 3rd December 19, A Party of Souls on the Way to a Higher Sphere, 21st May 21. Before examining the drawing on the obverse of each sheet, she turned it over to read the title. Try as she could, and she tried hard, Priscilla had never seen a vision or succeeded in establishing any communication with the spirit world. She had to be content with the reported experiences of others.
What have you done with the rest of your party?
She asked, looking up as Dennis entered the room. He explained. Anne had gone to bed, Ivor and Mary were still in the garden. He selected a book and a comfortable chair and tried, as far as the disturbed state of his mind would permit him, to compose himself for an evening's reading. The lamplight was utterly serene. There was no movement save the stir of Priscilla among her papers. All silent and all damned, Dennis repeated to himself. All silent and all damned. It was nearly an hour later when Ivor and Mary made their appearance.
We waited to see the moon rise, said Ivor.
It was gibbous, you know, Mary explained, very technical and scientific.
It was so beautiful down in the garden. The trees, the scent of the flowers, the stars.
Ivor waved his arms.
And when the moon came up, it was really too much. It made me burst into tears.
He sat down at the piano and opened the lid.
There are a great many meteorites, said Mary to anyone who had listened. The earth must be coming into the summer shower of them. In July and August.
But Ivor had already begun to strike the keys. He played the garden, the stars, the scent of flowers, the rising moon. He even put in a nightingale that was not there. Mary looked on and listened with parted lips. The others pursued their occupations without appearing to be seriously disturbed. On this very July day, exactly 350 years ago, Sir Ferdinando had eaten 7 dozen oysters. The discovery of this fact gave Henry Wimbush a peculiar pleasure. He had a natural piety which made him delight in the celebration of memorial feasts. The 350th anniversary of the 7 dozen oysters. He wished he had known before dinner he would have ordered champagne. On her way to bed, Mary paid a call. The light was out in Anne's room, but she was not yet asleep.
Why didn't you come down to the garden with us? Mary asked.
I fell down and twisted my ankle. Dennis helped me home. Mary was full of sympathy. Inwardly, too, she was relieved to find Anne's non-appearance so simply accounted for. She had been vaguely suspicious, down there in the garden. Suspicious of what, she hardly knew, but there had been something a little louche in the way she had suddenly found herself alone with Ivor. Not that she minded, of course, far from it, but she didn't like the idea that perhaps she was the victim of a put-up job.
"I do hope you'll be better tomorrow," she said,
and she commiserated with Anne on all she had missed. The garden, the stars, the scent of flowers, the meteorites through whose summer shower the earth was now passing, the rising moon and its gibbosity. And then they had had such interesting conversation. What about? About almost everything. Nature, art, science, poetry, the stars, spiritualism, the relations of the sexes, music, religion. Ivor, she thought, had an interesting mind. The two young ladies parted affectionately. Chapter 18. The nearest Roman Catholic church was upwards of 20 miles away. Ivor, who was punctilious in his devotions, came down early to breakfast and had his car at the door, ready to start by 10:15. It was a smart, expensive-looking machine, enamelled a pure lemon yellow, and upholstered in emerald-green leather. There were 2 seats, 3 if you squeezed tightly enough, and their occupants were protected from wind, dust, and weather by a glazed sedan that rose, an elegant 18th-century hump, from the midst of the body of the car. Mary had never been to a Roman Catholic service, thought it would be an interesting experience, and when the car moved off through the great gates of the courtyard, she was occupying the spare seat in the sedan. The sea lion horn roared, faintlier and faintlier, and they were gone. In the parish church of Crome, Mr. Bodiham preached on 1 Kings 6:18.
And the cedar of the house within was carved with knops.
A sermon of immediate local interest. For the past 2 years, the problem of the war memorial had exercised the minds of all those in Crome who had enough leisure, or mental energy, or party spirit, to think of such things. Henry Wimbush was all for a library of local literature, stocked with county histories, old maps of the district, monographs on the local antiquities, dialect dictionaries, handbooks of the local geology, and natural history. He liked to think of the villagers inspired by such reading, making up parties of a Sunday afternoon to look for fossils and flint arrowheads. The villagers themselves favoured the idea of a memorial reservoir and water supply, but the busiest and most articulate party followed Mr. Bodiham in demanding something religious in character. A second lich gate, for example, a stained glass window, a monument of marble, or, if possible, all 3. So far, however, nothing had been done, partly because the Memorial Committee had never been able to agree, partly for the more cogent reason that too little money had been subscribed to carry out any of the proposed schemes. Every 3 or 4 months, Mr. Bodiham preached a sermon on the subject. His last had been delivered in March. It was high time that his congregation had a fresh reminder.
And the cedar of the house within was carved with knops.
Mr. Bodiham touched lightly on Solomon's temple. From thence he passed to temples and churches in general. What were the characteristics of these buildings dedicated to God? Obviously, the fact of their, from a human point of view, complete uselessness. They were unpractical buildings, carved with knops. Solomon might have built a library, indeed. What could be more to the taste of the world's wisest man? He might have dug a reservoir. What more useful in a parched city like Jerusalem? He did neither. He built a house, all carved with knops, useless and unpractical. Why? Because he was dedicating the work to God. There had been much talk in Crome about the proposed war memorial. A war memorial was, in its very nature, a work dedicated to God. It was a token of thankfulness that the first stage in the culminating world war had been crowned by the triumph of righteousness. It was at the same time a visibly embodied supplication that God might not long delay the advent which alone could bring the final peace. A library? A reservoir? Mr. Bodiham scornfully and indignantly condemned the idea. These were works dedicated to man, not to God. As a war memorial, they were totally unsuitable. A lich gate had been suggested. This was an object which answered perfectly to the definition of a war memorial, a useless work dedicated to God and carved with knops. One lich gate, it was true, already existed, but nothing would be easier than to make a second entrance into the churchyard, and a second entrance would need a second gate. Other suggestions had been made: stained glass windows, a monument of marble. Both these were admirable, especially the latter. It was high time that the war memorial was erected. It might soon be too late. At any moment, like a thief in the night, God might come. Meanwhile, a difficulty stood in the way. Funds were inadequate. All should subscribe according to their means. Those who had lost relations in the war might reasonably be expected to subscribe a sum equal to that which they would have had to pay in funeral expenses if the relative had died while at home. Further delay was disastrous. The war memorial must be built at once. He appealed to the patriotism and the Christian sentiments of all his hearers. Henry Wimbush walked home thinking of the books he would present to the War Memorial Library, if ever it came into existence. He took the path through the fields. It was pleasanter than the road. At the first stile, a group of village boys, loutish young fellows, all dressed in the hideous, ill-fitting black which makes a funeral of every English Sunday and holiday, were assembled, drearily guffawing as they smoked their cigarettes. They made way for Henry Wimbush, touching their caps as he passed. He returned their salute. His bowler and face were one in their unruffled gravity. In Sir Ferdinando's time, he reflected, in the time of his son, Sir Julius, these young men would have had their Sunday diversions, even at Crome, remote and rustic Crome. There would have been archery, skittles, dancing, social amusements in which they would have partaken as members of a conscious community. Now they had nothing, nothing except Mr. Bodiham's forbidding boys' club and the rare dances and concerts organized by himself. Boredom, or the urban pleasures of the county metropolis, were the alternatives that presented themselves to these poor youths. Country pleasures were no more. They had been stamped out by the Puritans. In Manningham's diary for 1600, there was a queer passage, he remembered, a very queer passage. Certain magistrates in Berkshire, Puritan magistrates, had had wind of a scandal. One moonlit summer night, they had ridden out with their posse, and there among the hills they had come upon a company of men and women dancing, stark naked, among the sheepcotes. The magistrates and their men had ridden their horses into the crowd. How self-conscious the poor people must suddenly have felt, how helpless without their clothes against armed and booted horsemen. The dancers are arrested, whipped, jailed, set in the stocks. The moonlight dance is never danced again. What old earthy panic rite came to extinction here, he wondered. Who knows? Perhaps their ancestors had danced like this in the moonlight ages before Adam and Eve were so much as thought of. He liked to think so. And now, it was no more. These weary young men, if they wanted to dance, would have to bicycle 6 miles to the town. The country was desolate, without life of its own, without indigenous pleasures. The pious magistrates had snuffed out forever a little happy flame that had burned from the beginning of time. And as on Tullia's tomb one lamp burned clear, unchanged for 1500 years. He repeated the lines to himself, and was desolated to think of all the murdered past. Chapter 19. Henry Wimbush's long cigar burned aromatically. The History of Chrome lay on his knee. Slowly he turned over the pages.
"I can't decide what episode to read you tonight," he said thoughtfully. "Sir Ferdinando's voyages are not without interest. Then, of course, there's his son, Sir Julius. It was he who suffered from the delusion that his perspiration engendered flies. It drove him finally to suicide. Or there's Sir Cyprian." He turned the pages more rapidly. "Or Sir Henry, or Sir George. No, I'm inclined to think I won't read about any of these."
"But you must read something," insisted Mr. Scogan, taking his pipe out of his mouth.
"I think I shall read about my grandfather," said Henry Wimbush, "and the events that led up to his marriage with the eldest daughter of the last Sir Ferdinando."
"Good," said Mr. Scogan. "We are listening."
"Before I begin reading," said Henry Wimbush, looking up from the book and taking off the pince-nez which he had just fitted to his nose, "before I begin, I must say a few preliminary words about Sir Ferdinando, the last of the Lapiths. At the death of the virtuous and unfortunate Sir Hercules, Ferdinando found himself in possession of the family fortune, not a little increased by his father's temperance and thrift. He applied himself forthwith to the task of spending it, which he did in an ample and jovial fashion. By the time he was 40, he had eaten, and above all, drunk and loved away about half his capital, and would infallibly have soon got rid of the rest in the same manner, if he had not had the good fortune to become so madly enamoured of the rector's daughter as to make a proposal of marriage. The young lady accepted him, and in less than a year had become the absolute mistress of Chrome and her husband. An extraordinary reformation made itself apparent in Sir Ferdinando's character. He grew regular and economical in his habits. He even became temperate, rarely drinking more than a bottle and a half of port at a sitting. The waning fortune of the Lapiths began once more to wax, and that in despite of the hard times, for Sir Ferdinando married in 1809, in the height of the Napoleonic Wars. A prosperous and dignified old age, cheered by the spectacle of his children's growth and happiness, for Lady Lapith had already borne him 3 daughters, and there seemed no good reason why she should not bear any more of them, and sons as well. A patriarchal decline into the family vault seems now to be Sir Ferdinando's enviable destiny. But Providence willed otherwise. To Napoleon, cause already of such infinite mischief, was due, though perhaps indirectly, the untimely and violent death which put a period to this reformed existence. Sir Ferdinando, who was above all things a patriot, had adopted from the earliest days of the conflict with the French his own peculiar method of celebrating our victories. When the happy news reached London, it was his custom to purchase immediately a large store of liqueur, and, taking a place on whichever of the outgoing coaches he happened to light on first, to drive through the country proclaiming the good news to all he met on the road and dispensing it, along with the liqueur, at every stopping place to all who cared to listen or drink. Thus, after the Nile, he had driven as far as Edinburgh, and later, when the coaches wreathed with laurel for triumph, with cypress for mourning, were setting out with the news of Nelson's victory and death. He sat through all a chilly October night in the box of the Norwich Meteor, with a nautical keg of rum on his knees and 2 cases of old brandy under the seat. This genial custom was one of the many habits which he abandoned on his marriage. The victories in the peninsula, the retreat from Moscow, Leipzig, and the abdication of the tyrant all went uncelebrated. It so happened, however, that in the summer of 1815, Sir Ferdinando was staying for a few weeks in the capital. There had been a succession of anxious, doubtful days. Then came the glorious news of Waterloo.
It was too much for Sir Ferdinando. His joyous youth awoke again within him. He hurried to his wine merchant and bought a dozen bottles of 1760 brandy. The Bath coach was on the point of starting. He bribed his way onto the box and, seated in glory beside the driver, proclaimed aloud the downfall of the Corsican bandit and passed about the warm, liquid joy. They clattered through Uxbridge, Slough, Maidenhead. Sleeping Reading was awakened by the great news. At Didcot, one of the ostlers was so much overcome by patriotic emotions and the 1760 brandy that he found it impossible to do up the buckles of the harness. The night began to grow chilly, and Sir Ferdinando found that it was not enough to take a nip at every stage. To keep up his vital warmth, he was compelled to drink between the stages as well. They were approaching Swindon. The coach was travelling at a dizzy speed, 6 miles in the last half hour, when, without having manifested the slightest premonitory symptom of unsteadiness, Sir Ferdinando suddenly toppled sideways off his seat and fell, head foremost, into the road. An unpleasant jolt awakened the slumbering passengers. The coach was brought to a standstill. The guard ran back with a light. He found Sir Ferdinando still alive, but unconscious. Blood was oozing from his mouth. The back wheels of the coach had passed over his body, breaking most of his ribs and both arms. His skull was fractured in 2 places. They picked him up, but he was dead before they reached the next stage. So perished Sir Ferdinando, a victim to his own patriotism. Lady Lepeith did not marry again, but determined to devote the rest of her life to the well-being of her 3 children, Georgiana, now 5 years old, and Emmeline and Caroline, 2 twins. Henry Wimbush paused and once more put on his pince-nez. "So much by way of introduction," he said. "Now I can begin to read about my grandfather."
"One moment," said Mr. Scogan, "till I've refilled my pipe."
Mr. Wimbush waited. Seated apart in a corner of the room, Ivor was showing Mary his sketches of spirit life. They spoke together in whispers. Mr. Scogan had lighted his pipe again.
"Fire away," he said.
Henry Wimbush fired away. "It was in the spring of 1833 that my grandfather, George Wimbush, first made the acquaintance of the 3 lovely Lepeiths, as they were always called. He was then a young man of 22, with curly yellow hair and a smooth pink face that was the mirror of his youthful and ingenuous mind. He had been educated at Harrow and Christchurch. He enjoyed hunting and all other field sports, and though his circumstances were comfortable to the verge of affluence, his pleasures were temperate and innocent. His father, an East Indian merchant, had destined him for a political career and had gone to considerable expense in acquiring a pleasant little Cornish borough as a 21st birthday gift for his son. He was justly indignant when, on the very eve of George's majority, the Reform Bill of 1832 swept the borough out of existence. The inauguration of George's political career had to be postponed. At the time he got to know the lovely Lepeiths, he was waiting. He was not at all impatient." End of side 8.